So, Karen, what I want to start with is just briefly, if you can kind of give us the basic story arc of the novel, just a quick synopsis of what happens in Blood on the Threshold.
The main character, Mirabelle Garrett, is a up-and-coming economic development person from the Rio Grande Valley, from McAllen, and she is young and vigorous and just doesn't know how not to be successful. And the Mexico economy collapses, and her boss says, "We've heard of something called enterprise zones, and we want you to get one for McAllen." Well, there wasn't a state law, nor there was a federal law. So the story begins when I am in a hotel here in Austin, Texas, and I am preparing to provide testimony before the Senate Finance Committee the next morning. Then a terrible assault happens from a hotel employee, and I am viciously attacked. And the journey continues with my healing, my psychological healing, then the character's efforts to promote a bill that would allow hotels and motels to seek criminal background checks on employees, which they were prevented from doing at that time. We do, in fact, get the Texas Enterprise Zone enacted in the state of Texas and the Empowerment Zone program enacted at the federal level. So we have a little bit of economic development background. I tell my colleagues it's the only true crime novel set in an economic development stage. Then we go to to the healing and the journey toward forgiveness, and I settle in on perhaps not quite forgiving, but as close as I can. The second arc is a spiritual arc, because I have a spiritual awakening while I'm in a bloodied heap on the hotel floor. And that follows me over the next 30 years. And there's stories in and out about how I witness God and Christ in my life. And then the third became more apparent as it closes and as we approach today, because there are women victims in Texas that need help, and part of that effort was to provide legislation to allow hotels to do criminal background checks so it wouldn't happen to other women. Women need to feel secure in their hotel rooms, and the character felt secure in her hotel room. Didn't turn out that way. So we've got three arcs to the story.
So as you were answering the question, you actually said, "I was viciously attacked." And although this is a novel, this is actually built around and based on a true story of what actually happened to you.
It is. And I do slip out of character back and forth. The event did happen to me, and it happened here in Austin, Texas in 1983. And so it is a personal journey, and it has been actually is one that I could not speak of for 10 or 12 years. This novel took me about 5 years to write, and it was a difficult one for me to write because I first put it in third person because I couldn't really talk about it, that, he did this to me. It was easier for me to talk about he did this to her. And so I've gone through it, and a couple of very good friends and editors read through it and said, "You gotta turn it into first person." And I stomped off. I didn't want to hear that because that was going to be too hard. So it sat on the shelf for a few months, and then I kind of sort of started, and that's how it turned into the Mirabelle Garrett and the first person, which I think was awfully sage advice, and I'm glad that it turned out that way.
Just curious, about your decision to write about this in the first place? Because obviously it was an incredibly traumatic experience that happened, and you mentioned it took a long, long time to be able to speak about it at all. What part did writing about it play for you?
Well, I think most people will, you know, anticipate this answer. It was a catharsis for me in many ways. Writing about it was emotionally supportive. It kind of helped me work through some of the issues. Perhaps the most cathartic moment was in the courtroom scene where Mirabelle has to face her attacker in court, and he's 7 feet away. And I stumbled on that chapter for a year. I just didn't know how to put myself or Mirabelle even in that courtroom scene. And then an odd thing happened. I read and enjoyed The Help, the book The Help, before it even came out to the movie. But I heard that different voice of the black maids in The Help. And it occurred to me that I could approach that court scene through my assailant's mother, who's an African American. So I use that voice of hers in my mind. And that's why it's fiction. This is why it's not a new true crime, because I did, you know, go to the characters. But she was there in the courtroom, and she, in fact, sat right across from my mom. All of that happened. But that was a writer's block that I had, and The Help helps me.
So obviously an attack like the one that you suffered personally and that you write about in the novel that Mirabelle is the victim of in the downtown Austin hotel, tremendous physical injuries and psychological injuries. So there's a long road of recovery and healing ahead for the character, and as there was for you. Can you talk a little bit about, especially the psychological aspect?
It was a slow process. Part of the impetus of what I was doing is the Federal Enterprise Zone Act was rolling along in Washington, D.C. The State Enterprise Zone Act was going along in the state legislature, and, you know, I didn't control any of those calendars. And I was invited to provide testimony before the United States Ways and Means Committee, and I wasn't going to let that opportunity pass me by. As things turned out, my aunt lived in Washington, D.C. She was a colonel in the Army, so I could stay with her, and I didn't have to go to a hotel. And, you know, I still had a cane, and I was still kind of, you know, real wobbly. But I guess events sort of kept sweeping me up and moving me on. I talk about the emotional side of the healing in a kind of a matter-of-fact way. Everybody goes a different road. Everybody does, Jennifer. And I'm not saying this is for everybody, but I just decided to put all of that behind a big, black, thick metal door and just keep it away from my day-to-day. And that's how I chose to heal. It's just kind of put distance behind me. And kind of knowing that I'd eventually deal with it, but I just not now. Part of this story is Mirabelle is in Moscow, and she's coming up a very steep escalator and sees these big, fat, black doors retreated into the walls of the subway opening. And she looks at those 8-inch doors and realizes that's what she placed. She had a visual image of how she dealt with it. And at that moment was a bit of an epiphany as well. Because oh, that's what it looked like. And, you know, so I can begin opening my doors, you know, and begin to make sense of it and begin to share my story so others can not experience what I did. And I did that through law, and I'm doing it through the story, and I'm continuing to work on it through real-time victim notification.
And talk a little bit about that, the real-time victim notification. Talk about the work involved with that.
When my assailant was in preparation of release from prison, I was told that he was going to wear a GPS monitoring ankle bracelet. And I felt some security in that, you know. Knowing where he was would be a good thing. Or perhaps knowing where he wasn't, which was in, within 100 miles of me. You know, that was really the thing I was mostly interested in. And through the discussions Texas Department of Criminal Justice prepared me for being or what to expect as a victim of violence with an assailant out on parole with a GPS bracelet. You know, there's certain reports and certain things you have to sign up for and certain methods of communication and passcodes and things like that. And I asked the question, just really as an aside, and said, well, how do I know if he slips off his bracelet or goes beyond his safe zone? And the answer came back, well, by U.S. Post.
A letter.
Yes, a letter. And for me, that was not acceptable. In this day and age of parents being able to monitor their kids' whereabouts via a smartphone, having the contact with the Texas Department of Criminal Justice through a letter in the mail was not acceptable to me. And remember, I had been active in the statute to allow hotels to do criminal background checks. I've also been active in a federal law and a state law. So when I say this is not right, I'm just not going to sit down and paint my nails and worry about it. I just went out and started asking questions. Senator Hinojosa was a big help. He lent me his staff to start doing the background and start doing the work. And real-time victim notification is a means where registered victims of violent crimes with assailants who are in the Texas prison system can or might receive a text in real time should their assailant go off the grid. Now, even though I got an email that was forwarded to me as a text, it was still 32 hours later. And when a person can cross the entire state of Texas in 8 hours, that doesn't do a person potentially much good. So I am seeking to do real-time victim notification. And the technology is there, Jennifer. It's absolutely there. Because the service that the Department of Criminal Justice uses, it's a third-party provider, is doing real-time victim notification in 6 other states already, just not in Texas.
What's the holdup here?
Well, turns out that it's not a statutory holdup, according to Senator Hinojosa's office. We've looked at it. We've talked with the governor's office. It's not a problem with the law. The law is permissive in that way. Turns out that it's a contractual provision where the Department of Criminal Justice contracts with this third-party vendor that does notifications for 34 other states. And 6 of those states, they do real-time notification, but not in Texas. So we have worked with the cooperation and in enthusiastic support from victims' notification. I have received no pushback on any of this from the governor's office, from the OAG's office, from Representative Nashtash. He's been great, Senator Hinojosa. Like, well, let's put it in the contract. What's the holdup? And the money is not even significant in this huge contract. So I am hoping that the contract has this provision. It won't be released for the public for a few weeks now. But I am hoping that Texas women will receive real-time victim notification maybe by the end of this year.
So it sounds like this work is part of kind of the bigger picture ongoing healing process and processing and continuing to make sense of this event and moving forward with life from this event. And I'm wondering about the role of forgiveness in all of this for you. If that thought entered your mind and how you kind of worked with that concept of forgiving the assailant in your case. Did that come up for you at all?
Well, Maribel has a couple of really unique opportunities for forgiveness. And in fact, they were my opportunities. One element is that I sought to do mediation with my assailant before he left prison because he's now on parole. That was unsuccessful, but it was my first, attempt at seeing if we could talk about it. Another odd but extremely truthful thing happened years later. I was in a bar right across the street from the Capitol waiting for a representative, and he wasn't my person I was meeting was not there, and there was another person at the bar, and so I just sort of slid up next to him, just being the friendly sort I am, and just started chit-chatting. And it turns out that he was the head of security at that hotel that night. And he had been bereft with guilt. He didn't know what happened to me because he had cut off early and left his assistant in charge.
On the night of
the attack. On the night of my attack. So he asked my forgiveness. And I was a little, I was at first taken aback, but then I felt in his heart what he needed. And so that was really my first hard nut to venture toward forgiveness. I'm going to go a little bit further and say, I think we can separate sometimes what people do when they're not in their right minds, or maybe they're being driven by something bigger than themselves. And perhaps he wasn't in full control of what he did that night. There's a level that I am forgiving toward my assailant, but does that mean I'm going to have him over for coffee? No. I'm going to keep him as far away from me as I can.
And as you speak about forgiveness, it reminds me also of kind of the spiritual aspect of this story, of Maribel's story, of your story. And if you can talk about how that is kind of woven in also, because there's a place where that shows up quite vividly.
While I was laying on a bloodied heap, and, I was blinded. I couldn't see. I didn't know what was going to happen to me at this point. But the light of the Lord came down during that moment. And I had a little conversation at that time and chose to remain on this planet. So that conversation radically changed my view of having a knowledge that God exists, God our Father exists, rather than just than faith, because I've heard the words of God. And it occurred to me, the light came to me later when I was with Riverbend Church, Dr. Mann, and that light came to me in the Cave of Patmos again. And this time I wasn't in any kind of an assault or situation. I was just praying with a small group of fellow church members. So the knowledge of God in many ways gives me courage to push through these social issues for women. I think that's really the bottom line for me, Jennifer, is that people, you know, ask me, why are you doing this? You don't have to do this. You don't have to write this book. You know, you didn't have to get in there and provide testimony. And, you know, you just, and I said, because the Lord gives me faith that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And there's just simply no question in my mind. And I rely on his angels to guide me forward in this venture.
Karen Richmond is the author of Blood on the Threshold, a novel based on true events that happened to Karen. And we thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story with us.
Can't tell you how privileged I am to be here.